It is Wednesday, September 22nd, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Daniel Mello, immigration lawyer, author of Borderlines, The Edges of U.S. Capitalism, Immigration, and Democracy. Also on the program today, last night, the House approves a continuing resolution punting the question of the budget, extending it, and a debt ceiling raise. However, it heads to the Senate, where Republicans are all but certain to filibuster it. Meanwhile, the House, the White House, convenes Democrats from both the House and the Senate over the stimulus, over the infrastructure bills, as a push begins to blame progressives over the corporatists who are actually obstructing Joe Biden's agenda. Speaking of Joe Biden, he is facing a backlash from supporters on his immigration fails, and it started to show up in his approval ratings. Joe Biden's approval ratings are in the toilet, and they've been draining ever since that introduction of the bipartisan infrastructure deal. And speaking of the border, Texas Governor Abbott, whose own favorability ratings are also in the toilet, parks hundreds of cars on the border, ostensibly to stop immigrants from coming in, but more obviously to deflect from those dropping poll numbers. Also, that's not a joke. Court filings show Trump's campaign knew their voting machine BS was, in fact, BS. And at the UN, China vows to stop building coal-fired power plants abroad. And the U.S. vows to double its foreign climate change aid. And lastly, Joe Biden announces more Pfizer vaccine purchases to share a billion doses with the world. Of course, increasing everybody's Wi-Fi reception, 5G connectivity. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I, of course, was joking about the 5G connectivity that comes with the Pfizer shots. I think everyone knows that it's mostly the Moderna that gives you the best reception. Is that not correct, Emma Viglin?
Yes, it is. It's only the mRNA ones that turn you into a cell phone tower, though. The J&J one, it's still questionable what it does to your DNA.
You know, well, it's only 4G, that one.
Only 4G. That reminds me. The other day when we were discussing the J&J vaccine, we were characterizing it as a fairly old, or I should say typical technology. It is an adenovirus shot, and was corrected that really the only other time that we've used this is in the context of Ebola. So it is, which is why you get the 4G reception from it. But I just wanted to make that correction just in the way that we were sort of characterizing it as being a sort of more run-of-the-mill vaccine. The vaccines we have, and they've found now that the Johnson & Johnson is also very effective. And particularly, you could also get a booster with a booster shot. It would be super effective as well. So we have some very effective vaccines, and we are likely to see some type of approval for boosters for some cohort, at least, of our population very soon. And it's also likely, it appears that we're going to get the okay to provide vaccinations for children 5 to 12, at least the Pfizer vaccine. And they are, there's there's a belief that there's going to be the size of the dose is going to be about a third in general.
Something like 46 million children in that, I think, age group who are ineligible for vaccination.
Currently ineligible.
But could be open to that once that approval goes through, which would change things for sure.
Dramatically, I think.
Yeah.
You know, even if you had a significant percentage of those children vaccinated, mm-hmm. it's going to make the situation at schools much better. And as a parent and who is aware of, you know, I am breathing a bit of a sigh of relief, or at least anticipating one. All right, let's get to it. Last night we mentioned, or I should say in the headlines, I mentioned that the continuing resolution and the debt ceiling passed in the House as anticipated, mostly, I think, totally on party lines. Nevertheless, it's heading over to the Senate, where the Republicans are going to filibuster it. You don't hear about it. You don't hear it articulated that the Republicans are going to filibuster that much. It's just sort of they expect it not to pass. Now, of course, it would pass. There's going to be at least 51 votes, you know, and that includes a Republican in the Senate. But we have this bizarre rule about the filibuster, and the Republicans are obstructing it. It is not communicated to people. We should be getting rid of the filibuster. We're not going to. So that's the situation there. How that resolves, don't know yet. It could be passed by its own reconciliation bill. You'd have to have a voterama for each one of those provisions, and that's quite possibly what we might see. Meanwhile, we have this dynamic on the two infrastructure bills, one of which is actually the budget. The first is the bipartisan framework bill. The second is the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. There was a deal made by Nancy Pelosi and some of these corporatists who are looking to get rid of essentially tax raises that would come in the bigger bill for people over $400,000 a year. They want to roll back some rises in taxes, you know, the state and local exemptions that was cut out years ago. And so some of these corporatists, and they also want to roll back. They don't want prescription drugs to be less for the American public. And that's a huge provision.
Which would save the government money. All of these things, tax raises, Medicare negotiating with Big Pharma, all of these things would save the government money, which is what they say they're in favor of, but they don't want to actually implement programs to have the pay force for.
Listen, most of the people who watch this show are savvy enough to know at this point that the House Democrats that want to kill some of these provisions, they receive donations for their campaigns. They have friends and family who are in these businesses from large corporate donors who don't want these provisions in any type of legislation because it will inhibit their profit making ability. Same in the Senate when we're talking about Joe Manchin. And if you look at Kristen Sinema's donations, she is also there working on behalf of her donors. This is not an ideological question. When Joe Manchin brings up inflation, there's no ideology involved in here. In fact, there's no even wonkishness. There is no economist who are talking about long-term inflation at this point as being a significant danger. No one is doing that.
No one's serious.
No, yeah, and yet, it seems very, very difficult for members of the media to grasp this concept. And that's going to be part of the theme of the program today. Let's take just the first step of it, which is Pramila Jayapal was on CNN, and it has been clear before there ever was a fully formed bipartisan framework bill that the massive progressive caucus in the House, 96 members, at least a significant portion of them, were not going to sign on to any bill that did not contain, or at least did not, was not brought up alongside Joe Biden's bill of $3.5 trillion. You know, Joe Biden wanted a little more than that. Bernie Sanders wanted a lot more than that. And they settled on $3.5 trillion. This is the characterization. There is, you go back in history, the default, the baseline is, what does the president of the party want?
Mm-hmm.
That is where everyone's position is usually judged.
Especially when the president is Joe Biden and
right.
not, say, Bernie Sanders.
Exactly.
And the media usually goes along with that. But now that the Biden administration is in lockstep with many of the progressives and leadership in the Senate and the House, they still can't help but
it's really
blame
stunning.
Progressives.
It's really stunning. I mean, usually where the president is, and particularly one of Joe Biden's ilk, is the watershed. And everything is judged based upon where that is. We're watching a narrative where that's not the case. But here's Pramila Jayapal on CNN. And this is them developing this narrative that somehow it's the progressive caucus, not the eight corporatists who are trying to bring home the bacon for their corporate donors, who are somehow the problem. Play this is clip number two.
How many members are there of the House Democratic Progressive Caucus?
There are 96 members, and over half.
Pause it.
Yeah.
Pause it for 1 second. We should also mention this. Jake Tapper's been doing this for, I don't know, how many years?
He has no idea. The Congressional Progressive Caucus, right? That's a thing that exists. In my ear, producer, let me know. Like that, I've never heard of them before. Or chose to cover them honestly. So
there's another way you can do that. Too. You can say like, so the Congressional Progressive Caucus is nearly half the Democratic Caucus in there. I mean, so like we're talking baseline here. All right, so go ahead.
How many members are there of the House Democratic Progressive Caucus?
There are 96 members, and over half are absolutely committed to making sure we deliver both bills at the same time.
So 48 Democrats will vote against the House infrastructure bill if it does not come with the budget reconciliation package. Is that
right? More than half of our members will vote for both bills. And this was the deal, Jake, that came out of the Senate when progressive senators passed the bipartisan bill in the Senate. It was on the specific understanding
right.
and commitment that both bills would move together. And so now we want to make sure that both bills are moving together, and we're going to hold to that commitment. And so, yes, more than half our members will not move the bipartisan bill without the reconciliation bill being passed.
There it is.
Yeah.
and here's the point. Nancy Pelosi is not going to bring up that bill if she doesn't have the votes. And so that's the bottom line. I mean, Jayapal's folks don't want to vote against anything in that context, if they can avoid the bill coming up. Now, we'll see if Pelosi tries to jam it through, in which case they're going to suffer a loss.
And I don't think she's going to want to do that, because to reiterate, and Tapper could have framed it in a variety of ways, like going with the Biden agenda would have been one of them, that it's not in Pelosi's interest. It's not in Schumer's interest. It's not in Biden's interest. It's not, of course, in the progressives' interest to just pass the bipartisan bill first. The only people who want to do this and who are torpedoing it are the centrist corporate Democrats doing this for their own agenda. They want to kill the reconciliation bill in order to just deliver on the narrow framework that helps their donors and kill the human infrastructure provisions that might increase taxes on them. And yep. That's how you frame that question.
Meanwhile, let's look at this next clip of Pramila Jayapal on with CNN's Brianna Keeler. You're going to see a theme here. I mean, it really is one of those like days where the memo goes out. We know who we're going to try and blame here.
I'm actually saying that other people are willing to crash the entire Democratic agenda by refusing to come together on the reconciliation bill, which was the promise that was made. So I want to be very clear. We are the only people in the room right now that have said we want both bills done. There are other people in the Democratic Party who are saying we only want the infrastructure bill, and maybe or maybe not we'll get to the other bill. We are saying let's stick to the deal that was made, both bills, so that we can deliver real results.
There it is. She's got to lay it out because it's very unclear to CNN what the sequencing was. The sequencing was that the bipartisan bill only passed because there was an agreement to bring it up in the House with the reconciliation bill simultaneously, so that everybody has to jump at once.
She's got to say it real slow, so you understand.
Well, apparently, and we will play this later in the program, Chris Cuomo does not watch CNN in the mornings and didn't have someone explain it to him very slowly. But we will talk about that later. Going to take a quick break. And we will be back with Daniel Mello, immigration lawyer, author of Borderlines, The Edges of U.S. Capitalism, Immigration, and Democracy. Be right back after this. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can help the show thrive and survive. Well, I guess really it would be more like sequentially. It would be survive and
then thrive. Right.
But surviving through thriving.
Well, I want to thrive just enough to like barely survive.
There you go.
Yeah, I know. Live hard, die young.
You go to jointhemajorityreport.com and become a member today. And a reminder, if you're one of those people who want the fun half, but you can't, you're in financial issues at the moment, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have a little patience with us because it takes a while to go through all the emails. But we will hook you up in some manner that will be good for you, I guess. It's really the way. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And lastly, check out the AM Quickie. Go to majority.fm, scroll down to the bottom, sign up for the emails. Every day, we give you a breakdown of some of the top stories that, and stories that you may not hear. It's a little mix. And check it out. It's a quick read, gives you a good start of your day. All right. Want to welcome Daniel Mello. He is a public sector immigration lawyer, author of Borderlines, The Edges of U.S. Capitalism, Immigration, and Democracy to the program. Daniel, do we have you? Oh, there you are.
Hey.
How you doing? Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, so glad to be on.
We're here with Emma Vigeland. And all right, so let's just start. I mean, obviously, some very big immigration stories in the news right now. In particular, it appears as if immigration reform is not going to be a part of the reconciliation bill because of this person who is the parliamentarian. Just some random, essentially, person who is some type of wizard in the Senate and can basically make a ruling on these things. We also have this situation where we have, I've seen different numbers, but somewhere around 15,000 migrants from Haiti who are being, I don't think the word is deported at this point because they're not getting any type of due process whatsoever. They're just being expelled from the country. Yeah. Ostensibly under the auspices of Title 42. Right now, I think as we speak, Greg Abbott has got an entire fleet of cars that are lined up along the border in Texas to stop people from walking through them. Like it's like a parking lot. Like I don't even understand. I mean, that is just too bizarre. Let's touch on those as we go through some of the things you've written, because I think they sort of in many ways illustrate some of the points that you make in your book. But let's just start sort of with the history and the development of our immigration policies, sort of broadly speaking, and what they're designed to do from the perspective of, I guess, like our capitalist economy?
Sure. So as briefly as I can, right, because this history actually goes all the way back to, you know, pre-independence times, where you had the first migrants, which weren't actually called migrants at that point, but indentured servants being brought over from Europe, from Australia, and actually being sold, you know, more or less, not on the same level, obviously, as slavery, but being sold into indentured servitude here in the U.S. So it was literally like early migration was around labor primarily, and the control between early colonies, but and then eventually between the states and the federal government. We had this grappling back and forth about that, about who was going to have the say over who came into the country and how. And eventually, you know, this ends up getting sort of resolved as just this kind of greater incident to sovereign power or state power from the federal level. But at all points throughout that history, right, we're looking at things through this lens of ultimately is a question of control, right? Controlling labor flows or controlling power. Some of the earliest laws around immigration were to protect the sort of hold that the original founding group of folks had over the country, keeping things like anarchists or even just poor Irish people from coming over and potentially usurping some of the early capitalist kind of dominance of the country. Even the abolition of the international slave trade, right, actually wasn't because the Congress at the time was interested in that as a humanitarian aim, but actually was afraid that the recent Haitian Revolution might get transplanted to the southern states and get kicked off there. And so whether you're talking about strictly labor concerns or more broadly preservation of power issues, that has always been the case moving throughout our history.
Let's move up into sort of I guess the more modern era of immigration, which I don't know if you would argue, but you definitely cite the Coleman Blease. Am I pronouncing his name correctly?
Right. I think that's right. Coleman Blease. Yeah. Which was the first, white supremacist from South Carolina passes the first criminalization. So the actual senator of from South Carolina. Passes the first criminalization, actual like legal criminalization of migration, which is in its own shape and form still present today, right? And so there's a little known piece of immigration, largely the ones that we know about, right? The context that we're familiar with is that civil piece where people are just trying to stay here in the country. But there's actually a criminal statute for unlawful entries or re-entries where people are charged with an actual crime, end up going to prison and eventually kicked out, right? And so during that same period that gets used, right, to criminalize migrants to CBP, the Border Patrol, would actually like take them at times to work on farms. They would donate basically their labor, and then once the agriculturists were done with them, then they would get removed or thrown out of the country, right? So whether we're talking about the civil level or, say, with Coleman Blease and the criminalization of migrants, we're still looking at that ability to control migration very tightly.
That happened in 1929, and there's two, you know, sort of like, I guess, sort of things happening in 1929. One, we're sort of like in the wake of a reemergence of the KKK and a reassertion of white supremacy, I guess you could say at that time. There's also, we're starting to, you know, head in to the Great Depression, and so there is a sentiment of, or there's an opportunity for concern about migrants taking jobs. Can you talk about a little bit about that dynamic and sort of how that, I mean, that really still, both those things are in effect, I guess, 90 years later.
Right, absolutely. I mean, that narrative is the one that we've heard fairly recently is a very old one, that, you know, you were heading in the Great Depression, there are fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer jobs. And at that point, like, there's a great opportunity, especially from the more racist elements and white supremacist elements of the country, to find a scapegoat, right? And so it's not, and when we talk about the, all of this stuff, it's like, it's not that there was always this sort of clear line of thought necessarily that was constantly guiding. It wasn't a conspiracy, right, at all times to control migrants. Rather, it's like there were just opportunities, such as, once again, we enter the Depression. There's this opportunity to criminalize them because, you know, we don't have any particular use for them right now. So why not look to them to blame them for some of our circumstance and get them thrown out? But then if you go on the flip side of the Depression, right, and entering the World War II era, suddenly there's a massive labor shortage in the country because all of our young men are being shipped overseas to fight. And so we literally didn't have enough people to man factories and the war effort. So Congress then turns around and authorizes the Bracero program, which is bringing massive amounts of labor, largely from Mexico, to come and start tending fields, factories, all of that stuff, right? And in that case, once again, not a humanitarian effort. They weren't allowed to bring their families. It was short-term labor contracts. And as soon as war's over and those needs start to die down, we start seeing massive deportation campaigns again in the late 60s, early 70s.
Can we step back just for a moment and talk a little bit of interject a little bit of theory here and talk, and this from a Marxist perspective, I guess, the critique of our capitalist system, in that there is a tension within the context of a capitalist economy between the idea that you want your workers to be able to afford your product, I guess, is like Ford would say. But also at the time you need to be able to exploit your workers because you need to make a profit. And so where does the immigrant and on some extent you've already sort of explained it in maybe more practical terms, but where does the immigrant, the idea of having an undocumented immigrant, come into that equation?
Absolutely. So yeah, so there is that tension, right? It's a contradiction within capitalism that it's like, in order to continue accumulating capital against the falling rate, the declining rate of profit, you've got to make up those differences somewhere, right? And immigrants, especially undocumented immigrants, are a great way to do that. And we can talk a little bit about how it even happens in the legal immigration context as well. But undocumented immigrants, you know, when agribusiness 5-10 years ago started complaining about massive labor shortages here in the country and their declining profits, what they were actually saying is that we're running out of cheap labor, right? That the consequences of shutting off the border and some of the other laws that had been passed two decades prior to that, we're losing our ability to maintain our profits and continue to provide cheap commodities to the populace, right? We're not able to compete in a global market without these laborers who are willing to work for substandard wages in horrendous living conditions. So when they're decrying these labor shortages in that context, right, what they're really saying is that we're losing our ability to accumulate capital off the back of migrants who are willing to work in these terrible conditions.
I talk about how that also functions in the context of legal immigration. And also, I guess we should also mention the dilemma that we have about both outsourcing the jobs from our perspective, foreign people, but also we have a problem with the job staying here and foreign people. There's a sort of a slight contradiction there as well, or at least a dilemma for us.
Yes, absolutely. So to use a fairly straightforward example, the H-1B visas, which are skilled worker visas, primarily used in the IT sector, we're bringing large numbers of folks from abroad here to the U.S. to fill supposedly big job vacancies in that sector. Well, of course, if you start to look at the numbers, especially around a few years ago when some of that was on the table and big parts of the discussion in that community, you see that it's this isn't entirely true. There aren't necessarily this huge shortage of American, and I'll just use that term loosely for the moment, American workers that aren't willing or able to fill those spots. And then if you look even more closely and you find out that, you know, the H-1Bs are supposed to have these protections, that they're paid the same wages as the typical citizen worker, and so that they're not able to undercut the rest, is not actually true. The Department of Labor gives a great deal of deference to the companies to set what the prevailing wage is. So what the companies end up doing, Microsoft, Apple, whoever, Google, you know, get to bring these folks over, pay them way less than
something
they would
like 40%
otherwise pay.
Less, right?
Yeah, sometimes just like categorically, just in a whole other tier of pay, which is of course for those folks in many countries is still a great deal more than they were making in their home country, and we can come back to that dilemma. But then at the end of that time, whether that's a year, 2 years, 5 years, the company is under zero obligation to sponsor that person for any kind of permanent residence. So essentially they dangle the person's legal status over them. And if they complain, they start to organize anything at all, they can just cut off their contract and they're out, they're gone, right? So it's the use of the law, the convolution, its complexity, its enforcement mechanisms to ensure that migrants sort of stay under thumb that way when it comes to maintaining profit and pay. Now, of course, some leftists, Angela Nagel comes to mind, right, of talking about sort of that U.S. protectionism or Western protectionism and saying we should be actually for closed borders because it's protecting local workers and local people from experiencing those kind of wage undercuts, right? But that is exactly the kind of, in my opinion, regressive and almost reactionary thinking that's only going to set us further back, right? Instead of looking to how the populations abroad might be undercutting wages, we should instead be turning our focus to instead look and say, okay, but why? Why is it that we are seeing these migration patterns, or why is it that the capitalists need to undercut folks at all? And instead focusing in on the fact that it's like, no, the people who get to make these decisions, the folks that have the power over this, that is where we need to turn our focus to.
I mean, it raises the point that when we think about, HB1 visas, how those laws get made. I mean, it's not terribly dissimilar from our tax codes, largely, which is the corporations who have the greatest interest in this deploy the greatest amount of political pressure through lobbyists and through other programs. And, you know, even if you have lawmakers with the purest of intentions, which I'm only saying for the sake of,
right.
of
argument, sure.
The shaping of these laws reflect the desires and, you know, according to them, needs of these corporations, and their need is to get the cheapest amount of labor they possibly can in those instances. There was I just saw a tweet in regards to sort of the notion of, you know, where we're going to cut off unemployment benefits we have for workers with the hopes that, you have businesses saying like, you know, there's a shortage of labor here. And they made the point that like nobody goes into a car dealership and says, I want to buy an Audi, but, I only got like $6,000. There's a shortage of Audis. I can't find one. It's because, you're not paying for it. And that it, there's that dynamic to it. All right. So, but let's. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So let's talk about those forces, because I mean, ultimately, when we start to talk about, like, you know, how to deal with these things, like, talk about those forces that create this dynamic, where, because there is an argument on the left that that is comes in and out of favor at different times, that the allowance of migrants coming in would suppress his wages for American workers, and you know, certainly short of some type of immediate path to citizenship where they're getting the maybe anemic but some protections that that American workers were, there's going to be that element of it.
Right, exactly. And I think you targeted the solution in the question, right? But the exact same argument was made when women started to enter the workforce, right? That it's like unions talked about barring women from membership, barring women from, you know, participating in the workforce at all, for that exact reason, right? That it's like they're going to be used to undercut our wages. And if we allow the ruling, you know, ruling parties, the ruling class, the capitalists, to dictate that to us, then yes, it would absolutely be true, right? That it's like they can and they will be used against other members of the working class if we allow them to do that. And so it's cliche, but it's like we've got to gather up then the strength of the working class and again turn, not look to them as opponents over scarce resources, but start to ask the question, who is it that's getting to decide how these resources are divvied up in the first place? Right. And so to that end, you know, the work right now that I'm trying to do to a greater or lesser extent and many others are trying to find that legal footing for folks to help get them out from under the system long enough so that we can also start to organize a level of collective, you know, citizen, non-citizen, whatever status, solidarity towards achieving that goal.
We should say that, you know, the forces, I mean, we you know, we can see this even in play of like things like as to dropping the eligibility age for Medicare, right? Like, yeah. There are some of the opponents of that are medical care providers who don't want to have price constraints on the care that they're providing. But then there's sort of like a generic capitalist class that are like, wait a second, this is going to create a little bit of scarcity when it comes to our workforce, because if I can get healthcare at age 60 or 55, maybe I choose to retire or cut back the hours I'm going to work or not take this job because I'm getting healthcare, which is a significant expense at that age and is, you know, a big motivation for people staying in work that they don't want to be in, whether it's to get more money to pay for healthcare or because it's being offered there. And so there's knock-on effects. And so that's where, you know, the medical care providers get their solidarity, I guess, with just generic people who want to suppress wages. So we have this dynamic. Before we get to sort of more solutions that you suggest, I want to just go back and get sort of some of the practical and sort of real world examples that you have of the way that we sell this dynamic and maybe mystify it a little bit in the context of American politics. Like when we start talking about, you know, why should these immigrants who are coming in from Haiti just skip the line and all of these things. I mean, I guess talk about the different sort of narratives that are deployed that obscure what the actual dynamic is going on here.
Absolutely. Right. Like, to go a little bit further back than Haiti for a moment, you know, we had earlier in the summer or late spring, you know, Vice President Kamala Harris was in Central America, you know, giving basically these talks. And then I think it was in Guatemala or maybe it was El Salvador. I can't remember which country she was in. She actually like explicitly says, don't come. We will enforce our laws. don't come, right? And a piece that I wrote, like, I pointed out the fact that it's like she has the benefit in this case, and to go to that point that you made about obscuring it, right, she has the benefit of time here where she doesn't have to talk about the fact that the last 100 or so, 150-odd years, the U.S. has been involved in some meaningful way, often militarily, throughout most of Latin America. And in large cases has just resulted in massive destabilization politically, economically, and socially, just huge destabilization. But she gets to go up there, right, because there's such a gap of time, because memory is so short here, gets to go up there, and after 150-odd years of imperialist policy that's basically helped create the conditions that force people to migrate to other places, gets to say, you know, you guys have a big corruption problem here and you need to figure it out, but don't look to us for solutions, right? You guys need to stay here and figure it out. Don't bother coming up here, right? And so this narrative just gets recapitulated over and over and over and over again in U.S. politics around migration, because it largely tends to focus on merit, right? Like, who should be here? The line, you know, is a big, big one of those, right? That people should just get in line. It's like, well, it's not, anyone can't just go to their, you know, their local U.S. embassy and say, you know, I'd really like to hop, can I take a number and get in line, you know, to jump on a plane to the U.S.? It doesn't exist. You have to have a legal vehicle to get here. So let's take the common one, family petitions. For example, for a brother or sister of a U.S. citizen who's in Mexico right now, the wait is 1996, I think, right now. You had to have an approved petition that was filed for you in 1996, and they'll give you a visa today.
So it's a 25-year wait if you have family members in this country.
Right, a U.S. citizen family member here in this country. You know, even for grown children, we're still talking about sometimes somewhere between 3 and 15-year waits for you to be able to bring, you know, your child, even if they're grown now, your child here to the U.S., right? And so, you know, when you have that closing off, when asylum is so very strict in terms of the means of lawfully entering the country with some kind of legal status, people are, you know, there's a quote from, I think it was the Second International, that talked about the fact that it's like the whip that drives migrants, the whip of hunger, is going to be stronger than any law that anyone ever passes, and any border that you ever set up, right? And so long as the capitalist forces are at work that are displacing people and causing this level of immiseration, we're always going to have migration, right? But what we lose is in the current level of debate is that very dynamic, right? The driving forces behind that, and instead we end up just talking about who deserves to stay or doesn't deserve to stay, which often centers around some sort of, you know, like, well, their personal situation just wasn't quite horrifying enough and therefore they can't stay. So, you know, to jump back to Haiti, it's like the fact that there were, you know, two major disasters and a political assassination, generally not enough to merit asylum.
Well, and I want to just return to this concept of enforcing laws that you brought up that Kamala Harris used as a part of her just stay home speech in South America. I wonder what your take is on the usage of like international law in some of these debates, because yes, international law says that we need to accept asylum seekers, and even U.S. law says that, right? But a lot of times laws like how Kamala Harris used it can be deployed in a way that upholds capital and upholds inequity and exploitation. And it seems to me, one, she's not enforcing our laws, right, because of our asylum laws. But at the same time, she can say, oh, I'm enforcing, at the time at least, Title 42, which is our law. So in using that, is it more of a helpful tool for us as progressives and your work and what we're trying to achieve? Or is it usually deployed more cynically, like by people like Kamala Harris?
Honestly, mostly the latter, right? like the law generally, and I try to point this out multiple times in the text, is like the law most of the time is used as a tool of exclusion rather than inclusion, right? And there's a level at which, and we don't have time today, but like there's a level at which that's just inherent in the nature of nation states and citizenship, because it is a question of who is included in the we. But even more broadly, it's like the international context, there's no guarantees whatsoever. And the Jewish refugee scholar, philosopher Hannah Arendt talks a little bit about this, that it's like the refugee actually is the true person of rights because they have no guarantors of those. They exist only in and of themselves. And in many ways, the fact that there is no nation to protect them proves that this concept of citizenship is actually broken.
I mean, just to expand a little bit on that, because I think that's important for people to understand this sort of notion of like the failure of the idea that you can have people sort of in between being a citizen and not, sort of stuck in this netherworld, is an indictment of the concept of citizenship.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the millions of refugees worldwide is a daily indictment of that, in my opinion. Because, you know, to use a recent example of Afghanistan, right, it's like we have 20 years of conflict there, millions of displaced people. There's no one, literally no one, that's accountable to them. No nation is required to take them on. The U.S. has no responsibility to bring any of them here. It's really only by the goodwill of a handful of places that they even get the paltry, you know, refugee camps that, you know, are set up throughout the globe, right? So yes, in that sense, right, the concept of citizenship is broken because the idea that everyone belongs somewhere and has protection from someone is inherently untrue.
So, all right, what do we do in this context? I mean, like, how do we, and is there really one thing to do? I mean, can you actually address this dilemma without addressing a whole series of other dilemmas?
I think the honest and the straightforward answer is no, right? Like, we're not going to suddenly open up borders tomorrow in the U.S. and solve the global migration crisis. We could do that for, you know, all of North America. And while it would go a long way, it still is not going to overcome the problems that are inherent in capitalism that help create, you know, the mass displacement of people in the first instance, right? So it is a tension. It's a tension that, frankly, gets rehashed within the movement all of the time of, like, what do we target first? Do we try to legalize as many people as possible in order to have them be better protected and better able to organize? Do we not, you know, do we skip that? Do we focus on, you know, just struggles? But I think one fundamental piece that just cannot be left off the table is the constant reminder, especially on the left, that the citizen-migrant dichotomy was not set up by us as a collective, is not democratic. There's nothing inherently democratic about it. And that, more importantly, that divide over and over helps reinforce the status quo. And so by first fundamentally questioning that divide, demanding justification for why is it that things are this way, I think we can at least have groundwork to start moving towards something more equitable.
Well, so what does that groundwork look like? I mean, like, you know, I'm not looking for maybe necessarily specific policies, but I mean, if
sure.
You go forward in that way, you know, because it's a fascinating time where I feel like there's arguments on the left for like a new nationalism coming from the left on some level, but that which also cuts against that notion of like, but are we, you know, there are victims of that. I mean, we're looking at, you know, 15,000 of them right now, being sent to a country that has been, well, for, you know, 150 years, maybe, just, the, on the wrong end of American imperialism, and also, you know, just within the past, like you say, 3 months, disasters and political upheaval, at least the political upheaval, and maybe the situation, you know, how they're situated to deal with those the disasters is a function of what we've done in the first place. I mean, so how do you, what's like, I don't know. I mean, what would be the first, you know, practical reforms that you would do? Would you focus on making the immigration system more equitable as a first step, or something else?
I mean, again, you know, it is a cart horse kind of debate that's happening, chicken and egg kind of debate that's happening internally. My personal perspective, at least at the moment on it, is that there needs to be a two-pronged kind of approach, right? We need to start working to integrate migrants, documented and otherwise, into labor organizing movements, because they do make up a large part of that. But then also simultaneously, right, that from a policy perspective, the more that we can get the state off their back, so to speak, that we can eliminate the tethers that they have that allow employers like Apple or Google or whoever in that context to pull the rug out from under them, you know, reduce the means of enforcement, reduce the means of deportation, broaden, you know, the availability of asylum. Those things, unfortunately, are going to have to go together, because without one, you sort of lose the benefit of the other.
All right. Lastly, you know, you're an immigration lawyer. We have a couple that call into this program. I'm curious, just from that narrow perspective, what reform? I mean, what's sticking? What is standing out for you to be? And in your book, you recount the stories of a couple of your clients over the years. But what? What, as it stands now, sticks out to you as being one of the most unjust aspects of our, you know, immigration system, I guess, from the perspective of someone who is working with people going through it on a daily basis?
Right. I'd say probably from a practitioner's perspective is the Illegal Immigration Reform Act, IRA, that Bill Clinton signed. It continues to do untold amount of damage to people, to families, and more importantly, to even within, just strictly within the practitioner context, it created so many penalties that it's made it very, very hard for a lot of people to try to fix their status, right? And has helped create some of the immigration crisis, the ongoing sort of level of undocumented people that we have in the country. So if there was any one thing that I could just wipe from the books tomorrow, it would, from a practitioner standpoint, would probably be IRA and just get rid of it entirely, because it would help a massive amount of people. But to the extent that, you know, we had any other kind of mass legalization, I would, you know, in all likelihood would like to see something like that as well, to start building better groundwork for a better collective working class movement.
Basically an amnesty type of situation.
Yeah. And I would, you know, of course, that framework gets used. I don't think that people who've been here our whole lives, you know, we can call it amnesty, but nevertheless, right. Yeah, some sort of legal protection for them.
Daniel Mello, the book is is Borderlines, The Edges of U.S. Capitalism, Immigration, and Democracy. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, folks, quick break, and we will be back and wrap up this program for at least some of you. So just wrapping up here, we do have a situation where, like, can we put up the pictures of Greg Abbott's cars? Can you get that? It is absolutely, it's total insanity, but it gives you a sense of how immigration is used, or the question of immigration is used in this country as just a way of obscuring. Can we get it? Get it? So we got it. I mean, that's nuts, right? Like, this idea, they're just putting cars. It's just so stupid.
Do we see what kind of car? Because if he was being a real American man, we'd have the biggest monster trucks.
Those look like cruisers, right? Or
all right,
police
that's
SUVs?
That's pretty
yeah,
on
SUVs.
Point.
SUVs.
Be cool if they could, like, steal them and just drive them into the country.
Right. That, no, wait. Yeah. Hey, we're leaving the keys in the ignition.
Getaway
this is for
cars.
You to, yeah, right.
Also, I just look at some of these pictures, and I just wonder, like, how do they get their doors open? They just, like, park, and everybody has to walk out. Like,
get out the back?
Yeah, they're going to have to do it one at a time. It's just a silly stunt, and it's disgusting. All right, well, that is all our time. If you're watching us on Peacock, we will say goodbye and see you tomorrow.
Goodbye and see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Hey.
And for those of you who are not, we're back. All right, so we're going to go into the fun half. We got more to talk about, specifically dealing with the way the media is already attempting to frame. And look, this is not to be unexpected. I tweeted out something about Chris Cuomo, and we're going to play the clip. But I tweeted out in a sort of like a way to sort of say, like, why is Chris Cuomo doing this? I know why Chris Cuomo's doing it, because whatever reason. But the responses for some people are just like, where have
of
you
course.
Been?
Of course. Like,
well, yes.
Are you hopelessly naive? How long have you been doing this? The Democratic Party isn't here for you, man.
Well, that part of it was just more like, Chris Cuomo, like, will you expect him to... I'm like, no, dude.
No.
It's a rhetorical
What's weird
trick.
Is people really don't pick up on sarcasm on Twitter.
It's not even sarcasm. It's just like, oh... Yes.
It's how to most effectively pose a question that shames somebody into action.
Exactly.
Or one that doesn't alienate everybody who might be, like, in on the fence.
Well, it's also, on some level, to embarrass Chris Cuomo. I mean, the guy has a habit of searching himself. And, you know, Twitter is really about trying to influence the perspective, and that's why they deploy bots. It's not because they think that people deploy bots. It's not because they think that they can influence, you know, the American opinion directly. No, they are trying to influence the people who have access to the bigger platforms,
right,
and give them a sense. And so when you pose a question like, why would you do this? You are basically setting it up like, this is just a neutral normative position that I'm starting from, and I'm asking this question not because I am ideologically driven,
yes,
but because this is merely a question of math.
Well, people just sometimes, you know, they
want to express their own savvy.
Well, it's not even expressing their own savvy. It's about only going for the kill and having one tactic, straight line ahead.
Yeah. Exactly. And the bottom line is, like, we want CNN to stop framing things in this way. Why? Because the Democrats often also feel that pressure, because they're still sort of living in the Beltway in the way that, you know, the Republicans, their whole project is sort of antithetical to government, and their people are on talk radio and are operating under a different formula. Well, all that said, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the phone number. You can IM the show by getting the app at majorityapp.com. Of course, if you want the show to survive and then subsequently thrive, you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget, Nomi Show tonight, youtube.com/the Nomiki Show. Nomiki Show.
Just commit to one.
Nomiki.
Just commit to
Nomiki,
one.
I think it is. Nomiki Show. Matt, what is happening in the Matt Lagane universe? I can't remember which one it is that I commit to.
Well, then,
time.
But like, okay, try it on. Say today's Nomiki, tomorrow's Nomiki.
Okay, fair enough.
All right,
fair enough. Wait, which one's today?
Today was both. You've already botched it, but in the future you can maybe just...
Or I didn't botch it because I did both. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian universe of media?
Yeah, tonight on Left Reckoning, you can subscribe to that on YouTube, folks. We have David Gerard. He's a crypto expert. We're going to be talking about not only why, you know, cryptocurrencies are silly and not currencies, but gambling, sort of funny money, but also blockchain and smart contracts are also BS, basically just to try to attract dumb venture capitalist money as, you know, the real reasons for Bitcoin, which is speculation, became more apparent. So that's tonight, 8 o'clock Eastern, or 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the post game.
I think you meant YouTube.
What did I say?
YouTube.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's YouTube.
YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube. See you in the fun half.
Yikes.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Can you bring back DJ Denner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.